listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
So after a long look, after a long investigation, after so many people have been so badly hurt, after not looking at the other side, where a lot of bad things happened, a lot of horrible things happened, a lot of very bad things happened for our country, it was just announced there was no collusion with Russia, the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration.
That was President Donald Trump this past weekend, reacting to the release of the so-called Mueller report.
It's a shame that our country had to go through this. To be honest, it's a shame that your president has had to go through this before I even got elected, it began.
The president also indicated that soon the screw may be turning.
And it began illegally. And hopefully somebody's going to look at the other side. This was an illegal takedown that failed. And hopefully somebody's going to be looking at the other side. So it's complete exoneration, no collusion, no obstruction. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Meanwhile, some have accused President Trump of attempting to influence the outcome of elections in Israel. This was the president at a joint press conference with Israel's besieged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington Monday.
In a moment, I will sign a presidential proclamation recognizing Israel's sovereign right over the Golan Heights. The state of Israel took control of the Golan Heights in 1967. To safeguard its security from external threats. Today, aggressive action by Iran and terrorist groups in southern Syria, including Hezbollah, continue to make the Golan Heights a potential launching ground for attacks against Israel. Very violent attacks. Any possible future peace agreement must account for Israel's need to defend itself from Syria, Iran, and other regional threats. We do not want to see another attack like the one suffered this morning north of Tel Aviv.
But while Israel won those two wars, we would have to wait nearly half a century until this moment here in this room to translate our military victory into a diplomatic victory. And that is why, Mr. President, your decision to recognize Israel's sovereignty on the Golan Heights is so historic. Your recognition is a twofold act of historic justice. Israel won the Golan Heights in a just war of self-defense, and the Jewish people's roots in the Golan go back thousands of years. And thank you for all you have done to make the alliance between America and Israel stronger and greater than ever. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much. Netanyahu's Likud party has been trailing the blue and white party of Benny Gantz, his opponent, in recent polls, particularly after an announcement last month of likely indictments against the sitting prime minister. Gantz is a former military chief of staff for Israel. In January, he too declared that Israel would never leave the Golan Heights, and he has taken an aggressive tone towards the rocket attacks that caused Netanyahu to return to Israel on Monday. This was Challenger Benny Gantz being interviewed by the Israeli channel I-24 at AIPAC on Monday.
Another rocket attack in central Tel Aviv. 7 people injured. This is the second rocket attack on Israel, on central Israel, in less than 10 days. If you were prime minister now, how would you respond to this?
First, I think he did good by going back to Israel. I think it's important. We should have a massive retaliation back. We must restore the deterrence that we had after Protective Edge. We cannot accept whatsoever any kind of attack from Gaza Strip, whether it's to the southern villages or whether it's to the central of Israel. We will have to retaliate firmly.
How would you do that? If you were prime minister now, would that retaliation involve a ground invasion?
That we should leave this to the operational echelons to discuss with the prime minister and currently under his...
But this is a role that you want to take, and you certainly have the military qualifications.
I'm saying...
So how would you handle it?
Definitely, but you know, as a general and as a security guy, I will not tell my plans in front of the camera. What I would say that I will use all means, air, land, sea, whatever it takes, defensive or offensive. We are by far stronger than Hamas. Hamas knows it, and he will feel it now.
General, you of course have a lot of experience with Gaza and Hamas. You were the chief of staff during the last Gaza war, in charge of Operation Protective Edge. And some in Israel and elsewhere have criticized your leadership in that operation. They said that the operation took too long, over 50 days, 51 days, that it produced negligible results, that about 67 Israeli soldiers were killed. They claim that the IDF wasn't prepared for ground maneuvers. And some have also criticized your comments where you said you wanted to take the moral high ground and you sent in troops at the expense of their lives, potentially, in order to minimize Palestinian civilian casualties. Many in Israel took that to mean that you put a higher worth on the lives of Palestinian civilians than the lives of Israeli soldiers. How do you respond to that?
First, I disagree with the criticism. It's true that we are in a democratic country, and it's true that political persons come up with issues and increase them by far more than reality for political reasons. Protective Watch was a very complex operation. We need to deal with 32 zone of tunnels, which we did. We maneuvered in when the government decided to do so, and we went one by one and took care of everything. militaries always take higher risk on themselves. That's the way military operates. I think we should keep the moral high ground. We will do it here today. I think we are as strong when we combine between military strength and moral standards that we need to keep. Don't get it wrong, and I'm sure that the Israeli knows it. When it comes running the dilemma between offensive operation and defending our country, we'll go for offensive operation, we'll take care of our civilians. No one was injured because of morality. It never happened. When people talk about this case, when Golani Brigade was inside near a hospital, we told them that we are taking care of the hospital. They have to be undercover. We made sure that this hospital is absolutely empty, and we wiped it out after we made sure it was empty. I think this is what Jewish soldiers and every soldier should do in the future.
General Gantz, we're here at AIPAC. AIPAC supports a two-state solution. What is your position on that?
My position is to make sure that Israel stays a Jewish state, a democratic state, and everything but a binational country.
What do you mean by that? Do you support a two-state solution?
We should promote any accord that can lead us to have a future, quiet, safe Israel for all its citizens for the Jewish people.
AIPAC supports a two-state solution. What is your position on that?
I support that we will not control other people. I support that we maintain Judaism as the main issue of Israel, Jewish democratic state, and we should make sure that it doesn't become...
Does that include the nation state law?
It includes that we are willing to discuss whatever can be discussed with any candid leader, just as I said in my speech. Any serious candid leader that wants to solve this issue. What will be the very end outcome of it? It should be discussed at the end of the process and not the
beginning. Do you have a vision of what a Palestinian, an independent Palestinian state would look like, especially considering Israeli security?
I'm talking about the entity that we see now that can change itself into so many different ways. We don't want to run other people's life. We don't want to run their welfare. We don't want to run their infrastructure. We don't want to run their economy. We want to live safe in our country. We will take care of the security and the perimeters, all the external perimeters. We will make sure that we have in our hands the security all over the area, because once we give this up, it will ruin down the Palestinian Authority and it will damage us. We have seen it before. So when we're looking at future arrangement, those things has to follow our security consideration, and this is what we will do.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also went to AIPAC on Monday and made the following remarks.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone. It is truly wonderful to be here tonight. I want to thank AIPAC President Mort Fridman, Board Chair Leland Pickus, and your CEO, Howard Kaur, for inviting me to be a speaker here tonight. And thanks to you for that incredibly warm welcome. As some of you may have seen, my wife Susan, who's here with me tonight, and I just returned from a trip to Israel. And we made a little news. You know, I've been to Israel many times, but it was the first time I had the privilege to visit our new embassy in the eternal capital of the Jewish people and the Jewish state in Jerusalem. Thank you. It was incredibly moving to be there. I also became the first American Secretary of State to visit the Western Wall, and the first high-ranking American official to do that with an Israeli Prime Minister. I then traveled to Beirut to speak with the Lebanese leadership about a big problem: the Iranian-backed threat of Hezbollah, the threat to Lebanon and to Israel, and we minced no words. And of course, it was a great honor to be on Israeli soil and to celebrate with Prime Minister Netanyahu at the very moment President Trump boldly recognized the Golan Heights for what it is, a part of Israel. As you, most of you would have seen by now, just a short while ago, President Trump, alongside Prime Minister Netanyahu, signed a decree affirming Israel's sovereignty over the Golan. What a truly great 2 days for two great nations. You know, that recognition ties in with my own personal connection to Israel, and more importantly, to America's connection with Israel. As a former West Point cadet and a former tank officer, I've had a chance. All right, for all you tank officers in the Army and the audience. I had a chance both while I was on active duty and while I was a student to study the great and historic tank battles that took place on those very heights. And it was really lucky for my family. On my first visit, I took them to the Golan Heights, and I had my son stand in each of the positions so we could feel exactly what it looked like to those soldiers on that day. My son reminds me it was muddy and wet, and his clothes were dirty, but he'll never forget the walkabout that we all took on the Golan Heights. You know, I mentioned this in my press conference that night with Prime Minister Netanyahu, that Susan, Nick, and I had a chance to gaze out of the Golan into the Valley of Tears, named for the vicious fighting that took place there in 1973. We saw what those brave Israeli soldiers would have seen. On the morning of October 9th, Commander Avigdor Kalani and the 7th Tank Brigade had been fighting for 3 days. They were totally exhausted. They were totally outnumbered. They didn't know what would happen next. Syrian tanks were indeed on the cusp of breaking through their lines. Yet they held on. Just when it looked like all was lost, a miracle took place. Tanks, reinforcements swooped in, and the Syrians retreated. As the dust settled, the voice of General Kalani crackled through the radio. "You have saved the people of Israel." How can you not be completely awed by these brave men, their defense of the Golan Heights, and their commitment to the country? And how can we also not be proud here in America, proud to know that their relentless defense of Israel, of Zion, was aided by the United States of America? In Israel's hour of need, in support of these great battles, America launched Operation Nickel Glass. It provided Israel with tanks, with artillery, with munitions, and all the other supplies that were needed to continue the defense of the homeland. Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir later said, "For generations, all will be told of the miracle of the immense planes from the United States bringing the material that brought life to our people." Without that battle, that battle at the Valley of Tears, and without the American support of Israel, there would not have been an Israel to recognize as the proper sovereign over the Golan Heights. And this relationship, from Truman to Trump, is a tradition of supporting Israel deeply. And I think about that every day as I serve as America's Secretary of State. But I want to talk to you tonight about something that I'm very worried about. Indeed, I am deeply worried about an old threat that is reemerging to Israel and Jews all around the world, the threat of anti-Semitism. It's a cancer metastasizing in the Middle East, in Europe, and indeed, sadly, here in the United States as well. In Britain, the Labour Party's tolerance of anti-Semitism in its ranks is a national disgrace. And France's Jews are under attack. The incidence of anti-Semitic attacks in Germany is also on the rise. Indeed, hate crimes against Jews in this country have risen by 1/3 since 2017. We don't have to go far but to consider attacks on the Orthodox Jewish community in Crown Heights, Brooklyn over this past year. And none of us will ever forget the 11 Americans murdered while praying one Shabbat morning at the Tree of Life Synagogue. May their memories be a blessing to all of us. Every decent human being has the responsibility to fight anti-Semitism. It's an affront to religious liberty. It denies the rights of Jews to worship their God. It attacks what it means to be Jewish, ethnically and religiously. But Americans have a special responsibility to combat this scourge, because religious freedom sits at the core of our founding. It's in our Bill of Rights as the very first freedom. It's the essential freedom upon which all others that we enjoy here in America are built. And it's because I'm a champion of that religious freedom and because I'm an American that I'm here today to tell you the United States stands with the Jewish people and Israel in the fight against the world's oldest bigotry. This bigotry is taking on an insidious new form in the guise of anti-Zionism. It's infested college campuses in the form of the Boycott, Defest, and Sanction movement. It's discussed in our media. It's supported by certain members of Congress, I suspect none of whom are here tonight. Now, don't get me wrong. Criticizing Israel's policies is an acceptable thing to do in a democracy. It's what we do. But criticizing the very right to exist of Israel is not acceptable. Anti-Zionism denies the very legitimacy of the Israeli state and of the Jewish people. Zionism reflects the determination of the Jews to live as free people in their ancestral homeland. It grows out of the Jewish faith. You know, Zionism was born in the Old Testament, crystallized under Theodore Herzl in the 19th century, and was realized in May of 1948, when David Ben-Gurion read aloud a Declaration of Independence proclaiming the establishment of the modern state of Israel. And yet today, only one country at the 192 nation, United Nations, has its right to exist routinely questioned. So friends, let me go on record. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. The Trump administration opposes it unequivocally, and we will fight for it relentlessly. I want to talk about why anti-Semitism is on the rise. I have a few thoughts on the reasons. First, Western civilizations, and our youth in particular, are losing firsthand experience with the Holocaust and its survivors as the post-war generation dies out. I saw that clearly and thought about it on my most recent trip to Israel when I visited Yad Vashem. Second, professors teach our children that Israel is the epitome of imperialism. Third, journalists who help drive our public debate don't always take the time to consider facts or think critically. And I'm being polite. But frankly, worst of all, some politicians think anti-Semitism can actually win them votes. And we have to correct the record. We all have an obligation to do so, because Israel should be admired, not attacked. Embraced, not vilified, and emulated, not ostracized. President Trump has made the fight against anti-Semitism a top priority. You can see it in our actions. In June, We left the fever swamp of the UN Human Rights Council, which since its creation has adopted more resolutions condemning Israel than all other nations combined. At the State Department, I reinvigorated the position of Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, and we have a real fighter in that role, Ilan Carr, who I'm so proud to have on our team. Last year, it was my honor to host the first ever Religious Freedom Ministerial at the State Department. I'm proud to say we will do it again in July. On March 15th, just a few days past, I took action to deter the lawless International Criminal Court from targeting Americans and Israelis alike. And the Trump administration and my team at the State Department is confronting the world's number one proponent of anti-Semitism, the Islamic Republic of Iran. You've seen it, not just in promises the president made, in our actions. We pulled out of the incurably flawed Iran nuclear deal, which put more than $100 billion in the pockets of the Ayatollah and funded the Islamic Republic's violent quest for regional domination. In its place, we've enacted the strongest pressure campaign in history against Iran and its proxies, and they are feeling the pain. As I said a bit earlier, I was in Beirut less than 48 hours ago. There, Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's terrorist-in-chief, recently begged for contributions from the very people in Lebanon that he and his Iranian masters have subjugated and terrorized. Hassan Nasrallah passing the tin cup is good news. Meanwhile, we're supporting Israel's right to defend itself with current 10-year military support to the tune of $38 billion a year, and more importantly, with the moral clarity that Israel deserves and demands. The list is long. Just a few weeks ago, we deployed one of our most advanced anti-missile systems in Israel, and you've seen the work of Mr. Kushner and Mr. Greenblatt and our team hard at working, devising a proposal to help Israelis and Palestinians find a just and lasting peace. Importantly, too, my team is working to mobilize and rally nations all across the Middle East to find common ground. In February, our Polish friends partnered with the State Department for a conference in Warsaw. Over 60 foreign ministers attended, and Arab leaders from all around the world sat with Israel's leaders. It was truly historic. But uniquely, frankly, in spite of its historic nature, it didn't feel historic. It simply felt right. Jews, Muslims, Christians working together to defeat Islamist terrorists, defeat the vociferous anti-Semites in Iran, and protect each of our nations was the right thing to do for each of those countries. We live in dangerous times. We have to speak the truth. Anti-Semitism should and must be rejected by all decent people. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, and any nation that espouses anti-Zionism, like Iran, must be confronted. We must defend the rightful homeland of the Jewish people. We must see to it that the old dreams of Moses, of Herzl, of America's poet laureate, Emma Lazarus, who wrote the verses inscribed on our Statue of Liberty, never fades. Indeed, we're reminded of the consequences if we fall silent. As I close, I want to return to my visit to Yad Vashem. At that memorial, those of you who have been there know, there is a list of people called the Righteous Among the Nations. These are non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust. 40 years ago this year, a man named Tibor Baranski was added to the list. Tibor repeatedly risked life and limb to save 3,000 Jews in Hungary during World War II. He later immigrated to America and became a citizen.
He passed away this January at the age of 96. In the course of his heroic labors, a Nazi officer held a gun to Tibor's head and said the following: "Why do you, a Christian, help Jews?" Tibor answered, "You are either silly or an idiot. It is because I am Christian that I help the Jews." Know with confidence that the Trump administration will not grow weary of the fight. To abandon it would mean to abandon our principles. And as Secretary of State and as a Christian, I'm proud to lead American diplomacy to support Israel's right to defend itself. And I am proud to stand with the Jewish people and to champion the cause of religious liberty in Israel and in America. These are special times, amazing times, and I want to thank each of you, and may God bless each of you, Israel, and the United States of America. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Finally, Robert Mueller has completed his investigation into so-called Trump collusion with Russia. There are no additional indictments. The report is finished, but the fallout continues. Crosstalking the Mueller Report, I'm joined by my guest, Xavier Moreau. He is the founder of the Center of Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. And in London, we cross to Marcus Papadopoulos. He is the editor of Politics First magazine. Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, gentlemen, I want to show what I brought here for show and tell here. This is a nothing burger, just like the Mueller Report here. See, there's nothing inside, nothing to see. And so we will keep this here as a reminder of the report here. Marcus, let me go to you first. In London. Everybody can talk about there's no new indictments. The Kushner family, Trump family, they're not implicated in all of this, you know, circus for 2.5 years here. But I think one thing that's not being considered very much on the cable networks is we still have political consequences for this ridiculous hoax that has captivated the political class and the media class, and the kind of relationship or lack of relationship that Russia and the United States has, and the kind of relationship that Europe has with Russia. What are the implications for you, and will they go away anytime soon?
Well, I'll say, first of all, that I think the wrong country was investigated. Because had Robert Mueller investigated Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Qatar's interference in the 2016 US presidential election, then undoubtedly he would have indicted both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But turning to Mr. Mueller's investigation, yes, it does, what was behind it has grave consequences for international relations. The relationship between America and Russia is even worse, yep, even worse today than how it was under Barack Obama. But there is another important dimension to this. This investigation has cost something to the tune of $35 million. $35 million that could have been better spent on tackling widespread poverty across the US. And I think the American taxpayer should be angry, and they need to direct their anger at the men and women who work from American mainstream media, such as CNN, because it is American media that brought about, ultimately, this investigation. And so I think that this is now an opportunity for there to be an investigation in America into the conduct of American mainstream media, because Robert Mueller's investigation, and I have a lot of respect for Mr. Mueller, his investigation has demonstrated there was no Russian interference in 2016. Yet mainstream media in America told the American public, told the world that it was. So they need to be investigated, and they need to be shamed for having lied.
Well, we're going to do our best on this program and moving forward to do exactly that. Xavier, you know, it's really interesting how Europe mirrored the U.S. during this witch hunt. I think it's an appropriate term, witch hunt. But it spoiled, well, made it even worse, the type of relationship that Europe has with Russia. For example, I mean, Trump's haranguing of Merkel over energy policy here. It's because Russia meddled in the election. You know, they are the mortal threat here. It actually, you know, supersedes, you know, common state to state reactions here, because you've created this boogeyman that, you know, you can't negotiate with. I mean, I don't see how you move back the needle, even though the report says there's nothing there.
Yes, of course. Actually, the problem is the European elite have the problem with the European Union. And actually, it's the same problem that with the elite in the United States. It doesn't work. But they don't want to take in consideration the real problem of the real people. So the best solution for them is to accuse Russia and to make Putin guilty for everything, every incompetences they have leading the country that they have in charge. So it's in my opinion, this narrative is very convenient, but at least it doesn't work. No, it doesn't work in France anymore. It doesn't work in Germany. And sometimes when we have some so strategic questions like energy, because, for instance, for the German industry, having the Russian gas, the cheap Russian gas, is so important that even this anti-Russian narrative doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
So there is some hope.
It has limits.
Yes,
it has limits.
There is some hope, but you know, I can when I observe what happened in France, sometimes when they have very no response to the French people, again, you will see this Russian gate narrative come back during the, for instance, the next European election.
Because
they have nothing else to say.
You know, Marcus, let me go back to you. We had a series of sanctions come into place as a result of Russian meddling. Well, if there was no Russian meddling, so I suppose those sanctions would be rescinded? Probably not, Marcus.
Oh, I think that would be a cold day in hell.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no chance of America's sanctions being rescinded. Of course, the pretext for additional American sanctions on Russia was the allegation, which, as we knew then, as we know today, was a complete fabrication. But then we also need to be realistic. America and Russia see the world in a very different way. They are the most powerful countries in the world. And so because of that reality, there is always going to be bitter animosity between the two, bitter rivalry. And I have to say that it is mainly as a result of America's unwillingness to share power in the world with Russia. Now, we spoke just now about the European Union. Well, one aspect of Brexit that is not being considered by many commentators is that once Britain leaves the European Union, and it is going to leave, there might be, and I emphasize, might be an opportunity for a slight improvement in relations between the European Union and Russia. Why? Because Britain will be gone. Because Britain has been doing the bidding on behalf of America.
Very good point. Very good point.
Britain that helped that put pressure on France and Germany to put sanctions on Russia. So there might be a positive dimension to Brexit in the context of relations between Brussels and Moscow.
What do you think about that, Xavier? Because we know that, you know, the support for, of sanctions, European sanctions against Russia are less and less popular. But it's very difficult for elites to admit that they were wrong, okay? And that creates a problem here. I mean, I remember during the German elections, you know, remarkably enough, a headline was, "Where was the Russian meddling? We can't find it." You know, this fear of not knowing what you don't know. I mean, it's gone so insane. Is that, you know, whenever something goes wrong in Europe, and a lot is going wrong in Europe, and I blame the elites that are in power, they don't take responsibility. They always have someone to blame and a country to blame.
Yeah, and actually, you know, it's interesting because we are talking about Brexit, but there is no Russian collusion in the United States, but there is U.S. collusion in England. Because I would like to remind you that Barack Obama came officially in England to support the Remain. So what we are talking about, it's like a projection of right. the guilt.
Well, what would have happened if Putin had gone to Scotland during the Scottish referendum? Well, that wouldn't have been called meddling. Of course, it would have been.
Yeah, of course, it's exactly the same. And in my opinion, and I agree with Mark that the Brexit could be a good occasion to change the game for that. Because of course, and if you look at what happened today at this time, the European Union want to have a hard Brexit. Because it wants to be a lesson for all the rest
for the
of
Poles,
the country,
for the Hungarians, for the French.
And so maybe yes, London will have to find a new connection with Moscow. And I would like to underline that the sanctions are not popular even inside the European elite since the beginning. Joe Biden said it. He said that when they decided to take sanctions after the Ukrainian
events,
only Angela Merkel agreed to do it. It means that François Hollande was against, all the other countries were against. It's Joe Biden who said it. So at this time, everybody know in Europe that the sanctions against Russia are counterproductive, something that to be abolished as soon as possible, but nobody wants to do
Let's go back to Marcus in London here. I mean, both of you bring up a very good point. This could be an opening here because we know that in Europe the sanctions against Russia are not popular. And with this report coming out, the nothing burger that I'm holding in my hand, would this be an opportunity to save face and to say, well, look, I mean, there was no collusion there. And the UK is out or will be out by then of the European Union to take a fresh look? Or has Russophobia taken such a deep, has such deep roots right now that would be very almost impossible to do?
Well, Russophobia certainly in London and other capitals in Western Europe has been embedded for centuries. It's certainly not a new thing. Though the European Union is not happy with the sanctions that it had to place on Russia, nonetheless, it is a strategic ally to the United States. The European Union at the moment is coming under immense pressure to stop trading with Iran. Yeah. Now, once again, the Germans and the French are not happy about that. But regrettably, Peter, when push comes to shove, the Europeans do back down. Why? Because in the context of Iran, the choice on offer from the Trump administration to the Europeans is this. You either have access to the American market, 300 million people, or you have access to the Iranian market. I'm not being disrespectful to the Iranian market, but in terms of business people are going to choose the American market. And just going back to the Robert Mueller investigation, I think it's an opportunity to really analyze and launch an investigation into Western...
I agree with you on that. Okay, Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you very much for joining us on this part of the program here. We're going to go to a short break now, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Mueller report. Stay with our team.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And now we go to Athens, and we're joined by Alex Crisafori. He is the director and writer for the Duran.com. Welcome to the program, Alex. This part of the program, I want to talk about media coverage of this entire Mueller investigation fiasco. That's my word here. Of course, we had a lot of tears, literally tears on Rachel Maddow's program. Poor thing. If I was paid $30,000 a program to talk about that, I probably, who wouldn't do it, I suppose, but I have a conscience and she doesn't. Alex, even now, there are Democrats, and of course, CNN reflects their point of view, or they're in lockstep, that they're so angry that they want to call Mueller to have him put under oath to answer questions about this. They want the underlying information and research and materials and evidence that is the foundation of the report. And no one's read the report as we're sitting here right now. So the media isn't taking it very well, but they didn't do a very good job during the last 2.5 years. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mueller was going to be the savior, wasn't he, Peter? He was going to save the United States from the evils that was Donald Trump. And now they are turning on Mueller. I think this is pretty predictable. It's quite fascinating to watch the meltdown, both on MSNBC with Maddow and on CNN.
I enjoy it. I hope you do, too.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very fun to watch. But one of the biggest consequences, Peter, of this entire Mueller 2-year-plus witch hunt, we got the word fake news.
Yep.
The American public now does not believe CNN, or at least half of the American public, half plus, does not believe CNN, MSNBC, New York Times. We got fake news. We got the deep state. Now, no one ever talked about the deep state before this. Now everyone talks about the deep state. We got corruption. No one ever thought the United States government was going to be, or is, this corrupt. No one ever thought that Hillary Clinton could rig the Democrat primaries. No one ever thought any of these things. And the Mueller investigation brought this out. It's incredible to watch the blowback to the media and to the government and to the intelligence agencies that this Mueller report actually developed into.
It's interesting, Xavier, because during the same time period, it's alternative media like where you are right now, and a lot of podcasts have essentially displaced this legacy media for exactly the same reasons that Alex Crisafora mentioned. I mean, people simply don't believe it, and they believe it is fake news, and they believe that they're not being told the truth here. And if you look at, particularly, I'm thinking of television in America anyway, even BBC in the UK, but, MSNBC and CNN.
In France, BFM TV. It's exactly the same. And, for instance, if we can talk about 5 seconds about the Yellow Jackets.
Yeah.
It's now impossible for a team of BFM TV to go in the street during demonstration because people want to kick them. And not because people are bad, because they know that this is a pillar of the power. Of the Macron's power, of the deep state power.
If you look at Trump supporters when he goes to his stadiums, they say, lock her up.
Yeah, because exactly.
That's their message to the media.
But the most interesting, in my opinion, it's a new Democrat narrative, the new journalist narrative for the Mueller report. Because first, it was supposed to be, as you say, the end of this operation, the end of...
Because it would be the end of Trump.
The end of
That's
Trump.
That's why.
But no, it's just the beginning.
It's just the beginning.
So,
right, okay, what Churchill's famous saying,
they are going to start a new neo-Mueller report by themselves. So it means that, they are a very good liar, because when you're a good liar, you never say you lied, okay? You continue till the end, even denying the evidence. And so what they do now, the U.S. journalist. And just to conclude on the French media, they don't talk about the Mueller report. For instance, I looked at on BFM TV, I didn't find anything. But when it started, when the accusation started in the United States against Trump, he's supposed to be a Kremlin, a Putin puppet, they were talking about that, and we have the same problem in France, in Europe.
We want to destroy
democracy, and so on and so on. But no, the last 3 days, maybe I missed something, but in my opinion, it should be, on the main page on the website of BFM TV or on the news, but no, Nothing.
Let's go back to Alex. Alex, you know, Xavier brings up a really good point, and we know that Adler wants to continue. He's and others in the Republican Party, Adam Schiff, for example. I mean, are they going to get eyeballs and clicks for the next stage of this? I mean, after so much of this was hyped? I mean, essentially, if you do the same thing over and over again and get the same result but expect something different, well, that's the definition of insanity, isn't it, or stupidity?
Yeah, this is terrible that they're going to continue to double down on this. And I think they have to because the Democrats right now have no platform, Peter. They have no platform. Their entire platform is built on AOC's new Green Deal, Green New Deal on climate change. They have nothing else. They have a lot of things that they could run on, absolutely, but they don't. They're going to double down on this Russia witch hunt, this hoax, and the media is going to help them with this. And not only that, Xavier also brought up a good point. We also learned how in bed the social media
yes.
giants in Silicon Valley are with the DNC and the Democrats, Twitter, Facebook. And because of that, we got a lot of new social media channels like Minds and Gab, which are now fighting the censorship caused by the Mueller report. Thank you very much, Democrats. Thank you, Hillary Clinton. Thank you, Mueller. Because of you guys, we have this censorship and this global crackdown on free speech and on alternative voices.
That's a very good point, Xavier. That's one of the, I hope it was one of the unintended consequences of all of this here. But they really want to, because of this whole hoax, they want to narrow political discourse. They want to yes. narrow discussions because we have all this deplatforming going on, and it's primarily affecting conservative voices. They just simply don't want to hear it. And it's really the result of the wrong person won the American presidency in 2006. Yeah. The people were wrong. The Electoral College is dysfunctional. We have to change that. We have to open the borders. We have to lower the voting age, you know, because of this terrible sin that was committed in 2016.
In my opinion, the left, the U.S. left, had another problem. It's because inside the Democrat Party, you know, there is some people who don't care about the anti-Russian war of the deep state. And for instance, I was reading a statement from Tutsi Gabba, the Hawaii MOP, and she told exactly what I think. She said that calling Trump a Putin puppet pushed the Trump administration to almost a war with Russia.
So, I mean, Trump being yes. a puppet, let me go back to Alex Christopher. I mean, this is so ironic here. I mean, which president recently has been the most anti-Russian president? Donald Trump yeah. has yeah. been, for God's sake. All right, but he's still Putin's puppet here. They can't shake that loose. I mean, again, a vivid contradiction right in your face. He's still mysteriously a puppet of the Kremlin. Go ahead.
Yeah, if he's a puppet, he's the worst puppet. And not only is he a puppet of the Kremlin, Peter, but this puppet of the Kremlin, they'll increase the military budget for this puppet of the Kremlin, won't they? They'll support him on every war that he wages, won't they? They'll support this puppet of the Kremlin for these things. For NATO expansion, they'll support him. So, I mean, it's the narrative is absolutely ridiculous. And the worst part about it, another revelation, the worst part is that you have these neocons that are now sitting in Trump's administration and they're pushing for more regime change war. You also have neocons, Peter, like Max Boot, yeah. Brennan and Clapper, who are on MSNBC. These guys got promotions after Iraq, and now they're talking on MSNBC and they're contributors on MSNBC. All because of this entire Russiagate fiasco.
It's interesting, Alex, because your point is well taken. The dreadful outcome of all this is that you have neocon capture of the left and right of across the political spectrum.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. They're everywhere now, and they're open about it. And people are talking. People are saying neocons openly. Yeah, we're neocons.
Yeah, well,
we're neocons, and we believe X, Y, and Z.
And neocons can never be wrong, even when they're wrong.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, I was very surprised because, again, I was looking at on Fox News, and main of the Republican MOP speeches was to say that, of course, there is no Russian collusion, but Russia He's a dictator, and Putin, he don't like democracy, no, neither in his own country nor in the other country, and he wants to be involved in the, you know, actually the narrative, the Republican, you know, the basic Republican narrative,
right,
hasn't changed.
Right, because we have here, and I want to, Alex Christopher to respond to this, we basically have a baseline now across the spectrum, is that, quote unquote, Russia did meddle in the election.
Yeah.
Then there's a subdivision. Some votes were changed. The other side says no votes were changed. And now with the Mueller report, either there was or wasn't collusion. So we have, according to Mueller, no collusion, or at least where we're told here. But the baseline is there was meddling. So that is really baked in now. Alex.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Peter. The underlying truth of all of this, whether you're MSNBC or Fox News, is that, yes, Russia did meddle in the elections. What that means, no one knows. What does it mean, meddle? Oh, Mueller indicted some troll farms in St. Petersburg. They don't even get that part correct. I wish someone would just tell them, there are social media marketing companies in Russia. Oh, my God. There's social media marketing companies in the United States.
We need another investigation.
Yeah. What they do is they harvest users on social media, so they get their emails, they get their accounts, and they build marketing lists. They take those marketing lists and they sell them to the highest bidder. Yes, these companies exist in Russia. Absolutely. Mueller, you want to indict them? Go ahead.
Xavier, you know, this whole event, this whole episode has changed so much in our lives right now, and there's no returning right now. I mean, and I think because of the injection of social media into all of this here, that is weaponized just about everything.
Yeah, but you know, I'm concerning France or concerning Europe. I'm a little bit concerned because we have not such a First Amendment like in the U.S. Constitution. So, what I observe now in France, especially, is they try to put some censorship. Even on the social media, with Facebook, with Twitter, and so I'm a little bit concerned about that. But I agree that there is new social media. We started working in France, for instance, the French VKontakte.
We're going to end on this note here because it's actually energized people like ourselves here. That's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, Athens, and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.